So we've got a lot of questions here. So we'll just go ahead and kind of jump right in. The school board has met twice now in the last couple weeks, finalizing and adopting the district's plan to start school with a soft open August 19th. But this is something the district has been working on for months now. Would you mind just kind of giving us an overview of what that opening will look like and what school is going to look like this year for students, teachers, staff, and even parents?
Sure. Thanks for having us on, KUCB. This is John Conwell, the superintendent of the school district. Like you mentioned, we have been working all summer to formulate this plan. I just want to start by saying, too, that I know sometimes it's difficult. This is a particularly difficult year for parents and for teachers and staff to plan for. We're trying to do a little better job from the school district to communicate with the community and particularly with our families. And along those lines, we'll be launching an official Facebook page this afternoon. So in addition to our website and our school messenger emails that go out to families, please look for our Facebook page with our district logo on it, and we'll be doing our best to keep that updated because, as we've mentioned several times before, this plan is ever-evolving depending on sort of the conditions in the community and on the ground here. Our plan is to reopen school on August 19th. We anticipate opening under the city's medium risk threshold, meaning that there's no community spread of the coronavirus in Alaska. If that changes between now and August 19th, of course, our plan may change. Our soft opening will be 3 days. It will be the first 3 days of school, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, August 19th, 20th, and 21st. We plan to run buses that day, but on a alternate schedule. So we will be starting school at 11:30 in the morning and dismissing at 2:30 in the afternoon. About 30% of the students, 30-35% of the students will come each day. So your children will only attend school that week one day. And this will give us an opportunity here at the school to sort of onboard our students and our teachers and staff and kind of practice some of these routines that we're going to implement to reduce the threat of spreading a virus. And, with that, I'd just like to have maybe each of the principals speak to specifically what their buildings will look like as we open under those under that soft opening. So I'll start with Mr. Eichenlaub from Eaglesview Elementary.
Hello, this is Chad Eichenlaub from Eaglesview Elementary. First of all, I'd just like to thank KUCB for providing this opportunity for us to share our plan with the community. At Eaglesview Elementary, we have rearranged classrooms to accommodate physical distancing of 6 feet. Classrooms and hallways have been equipped with floor markings to give students and staff visual reminders about appropriate distancing. All of our classrooms are equipped with at least one hand washing station, and our K-2 classrooms all have two hand washing stations available for staff and students. Students will be assigned individual items that are frequently used in the elementary school, such as scissors, markers, and manipulatives. Common areas have been retrofitted to promote physical distancing, and we've installed clear barriers in common areas such as the lunchroom and office. Schedules have been altered to support cohorting and eliminate mixing between grade levels. Our teachers will focus on teaching appropriate hygiene, respecting others' personal space, and appropriate use of face coverings.
Yeah, hello, this is Jim Wilson. I'm an Alaska City School District principal. And again, thank you to KUCB. Many of the items here at UCF will be very similar to what Mr. Eichenlaub described at Eaglesview. We've limited class sizes in order to reduce room capacities that allow for 6 feet of social distancing. We've been able to do that in all classrooms by doing some rearranging in the building and reassignment of classroom space. Face coverings will also be required for students and staff and any visitors in the building. In addition to masks, we also have a variety of face shields available for students and staff who desire those as an added measure of protection. We've installed plexiglass barriers in a variety of places. We're currently installing them in our science labs, in the bathrooms, on the lunch tables, in the high school office, just knowing that there's times where students maybe aren't able to social distance as well. But we want to make sure that there still is a measure of protection there for students, staff, and anybody who's in the building. We're going to increase sanitizing of the entire building. We'll have two full-time day custodians starting once school starts, and they will make sure that those common touch areas are sanitized on a much more frequent basis, as well as the bathrooms and any other, again, areas that need to be sanitized. We'll make sure that we have a good plan in place for that. In addition, we'll also disinfect the classrooms anytime there's a new group that comes into those. Each of those classrooms will be disinfected with a 1 minute contact time disinfectant that we have, which really helps to be able to move kids in and out of those classrooms if needed, but also make sure they're clean before having those students into those rooms. And then just finally, we're going to make sure we're practicing social distancing whenever we can. That really is our, you know, that in combination with face coverings. I think everything has taught all of us that those are the most important measures that we can do. And so we have markings in the hallways and markings throughout the building that are going to help to show students physically what that social distancing looks like. And then we're going to help as a staff to help to teach them those measures to help to, again, mitigate the risk of virus spread as much as we can.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think it's really nice for everyone to kind of have a picture of what things are going to look like when school does get started. So now we'll go ahead and move into some of the more protocol-specific questions that we have received from our listeners. So first up, this listener asks, because the CDC is not recommending temperature checks when arriving at school, will teachers have thermometers in their classrooms to do temperature checks if a student looks ill, if they're showing signs of illness, or if they complain of some kind of illness?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Maggie. This is John Conwell again. We will be sending digital thermometers home to every family along with a symptom checklist. And so we're going to be asking for families to partner with the school district to screen their children before they send them to school in the morning, for fever and for symptoms. We do have an ample supply of touchless thermometers here at the school. Our protocol for temperature checks has always been, to have the office handle those. But we want to protect the privacy of students. So our protocol for that would be to have the teacher notify the office and have somebody from the office either come down or and grab that child to do a temperature check. That's how we see handling that. But again, it's going to be important. Again, I can't stress enough for our families and parents to really partner with us on that and keep their children at home if they're exhibiting symptoms or if they're running a fever over 100.4.
Okay, great. So research shows that COVID-19 can be spread through aerosol particles in the air. Has UCSD made any updates to their HVAC system? And if so, what have those changes or updates been? If not, why? And will there be any updates?
Yeah, not getting into a lot of technicalities with our HVAC system. As you know, our buildings are fairly old. We still refer to the Eagles View as our new school, but it'll be celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. So our systems, they can handle a maximum filtration filter. It's called a MERV 8. And my understanding is those filtration systems are like one step below what most hospitals use if they're not using the HEPA. Our system wouldn't be able to handle the HEPA filters because they restrict airflow so much that it could risk cracking a boiler. So we have stockpiled a big supply of the MERV 8 filters. We plan to change those out more frequently than we normally would in a typical year. I actually was just walking down the hallways and noticed that we had personnel out vacuuming out the dust from the ductwork, and so a lot of work is being done as we speak to clean out our HVAC system. We are also researching the possibility of having some room HEPA filters, you know, that are portable. We're just sort of in the beginning stages of looking at those and as far as availability and cost, but it is something we're looking into.
And another question.
Just, I guess, one other.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, Meg, I should maybe mention, too, that, you know, we are going to, you know, as long as the weather cooperates, which is, you know, pretty late into the year, we can kind of open up the exterior windows, and we're keeping classroom doors open and get some more fresh air flowing into the building.
Okay, great. And so another question sort of related to infrastructure, and you already kind of touched on this a bit, Jim, but how do you plan to keep bathrooms clean and safe for students and staff?
That question, Maggie. This is Jim. I'm happy to follow up on that. You know, I guess the main way is the shift in those custodial hours. So traditionally, we had one custodian shared between the two buildings, and those bathrooms would be cleaned at night unless there was some kind of emergency situation. We've actually reassigned our custodians. So we have three full-time day custodians starting on the first day of school, and the plan is to clean those bathrooms basically on the hour as much as we possibly can, and we recognize that's important to clean, you know, both the bathrooms as well as those high-touch surfaces in order to minimize the risk of spread.
And in terms of kind of switching gears again, but still on this note of a little bit of infrastructure, how is lunch going to work? And I know it's probably going to be different from school to school, but could you tell us a little bit about how lunch is going to work?
Yeah, I think maybe this is Chad Eichemann, principal at Eaglesview Elementary. At the elementary school, we've altered lunch schedules to accommodate one grouping at a time. You know, in previous years, we'd have multiple grade levels eating lunch at once. So we've changed those schedules so that when we have one grade level coming in at a time, students will go to recess first, and then when they come in from recess, they'll wash their hands before going into the lunchroom. All of our lunch tables have been equipped with plexiglass barriers so that students can sit across from one another, still socialize, and remove their face masks while they're eating. And then in addition to that, we're also transitioning to some disposable trays and utensils to minimize exchanging items.
Yeah, and this is Jim, high school principal again, very much the same. We've altered all of our schedules as well to minimize the number of students in the lunchroom. Should have a maximum of about 35 students in the lunchroom at one time, or last year it could have been upwards of 120. So we're going to have one class in there at a time throughout the day. Also have installed plexiglass barriers on all the lunch tables so that each student has their own designated spot to sit when they remove that face covering. And then again, we're going to intensify cleaning of those surfaces as well as use disposable lunch trays also.
Okay, thank you. And in terms of those teachers and staff who are part of the high-risk population, a concern I know that has been expressed at some of the meetings, how will you actively support them? Are there alternative work options for staff members in high-risk populations?
Yeah, this is John Conwell again. You know, we're very concerned about our teachers and staff, and we have very many veteran teachers and staff members here, including myself, who might fall into that high-risk category. Again, we are providing personal protection. We've got these specialized face shields on order out of Juno. They're called Humanity Shields that provide an added layer of protection in addition to the face covering. It's a face shield that has a cloth attachment at the base of the shield that extends to the neck. That'll allow teachers a little more protection. We're encouraging our teachers to practice physical distancing too. It's the great thing about working in a school is you get to be with your colleagues and in close contact and working closely with them. And we're going to remind teachers that, as well as the students, that they shouldn't be congregating in places like the teacher's lounge or the hallways and giving general reminders along those lines. And I will definitely be working with individual case-by-case situations. If a teacher is in a high-risk population and is looking at possibly an alternative work assignment, we'll handle those case-by-case and as they come up and try to be as flexible as possible.
Okay, and this is a bit more of a specific question and kind of shifting back towards students a little bit. But one of our listeners asks, as the music teacher will be interacting with every student and music classes involve singing and a lot of forceful exhalation through musical instruments, what precautions will be in place to keep students and staff safe in those environments?
Yeah, hi, Maggie. That's a great question. Thank you for asking that, and thank you to the listener that fielded that question. This is Jim Wilson, again, the high school principal. We've actually been spending a lot of time working through this one. The National Federation of High School Activities has released some really good guidance related to measures to have in place for those music classes. They include social distancing of a minimum of 6 feet, repurposing your building to include larger spaces, and then increasing that space, if at all possible, to even upwards of 10 to 12 feet in combination with things such as bell coverings, which is basically, think of it like a face mask for your instrument. And what it does is it greatly reduces the particles coming out of the end of that instrument. And so I've been working closely with the music teacher, and we have shifted actually the music room into the auditorium. The maintenance staff has done a phenomenal amount of work in that space to be able to remove seats and really make it so, we can keep students a significant distance from each other. And, we believe that we're on the right track with that. We also have ordered portable HEPA filters specifically for that space. And so, we feel good that we've exceeded all of those recommendations of the NFHS in terms of those music classes to protect both students and staff. And, we know that music's important in our community, and at all possible, we certainly want to be able to continue to do so with the understanding that we have to do so in a safe manner.
And, hey, Maggie, this is Chad Aikenlob, elementary principal, and I'd like to add on to that just a little bit for the elementary perspective. We have actually also relocated our music room. We've moved it to the other end of the building to accommodate our music classes and provide more physical space for students and the teacher. Music classes at the elementary school this year are going to look a little bit different than they have in previous years. Previously, students would have spent their time singing during class, and our third and fourth graders would have gone into their recorders and learning to play those. This year, we're going to focus on a variety of percussion instruments, including African drums, rhythm sticks, and boom whackers.
Okay, thanks, Chad. Thanks, Jim. I'm really interested to see what these instrument face masks look like. So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. I'm Maggie Nelson, and I'm here with school administrators John Conwell, Jim Wilson, and Chad Aikenlob. We've also got Dr. Megan Sarnecki with IFHS on the line. We're discussing the district's plan to open later this month and the measures that will be in place to protect students, staff, and teachers. So in terms of the younger kids, especially in preschool and kindergarten, where one teacher is probably working with many children, how do you plan to keep those kids from touching, interacting closely with one another? How will you have shared play spaces? And could you maybe just kind of walk us through what a day will look like from drop-off?
Yeah, this is Jed Eichenlaw, elementary principal. really there's going to be a large emphasis on routines, a lot of patience, and a lot of positive encouragement, just getting our students used to the new procedures and routine. With the younger students, specifically with our preschool and our kindergartners, we also have some additional adult support there with our full-time aides. And then I can run you through a typical day as well for an AM kindergarten student. A typical day for a kindergarten student would begin with the students arriving between 8 and 8:30. Their parents are welcome to bring their kids into the school, but we do ask that all of the visitors to the school wear a mask and sanitize their hands when entering the building. From 8 to 8:30, students would engage in free choice and get to choose activities from a variety of stations. Workstations will be set up with appropriate social distancing and or plastic dividers. These stations would be equipped with individual bins to allow for disinfecting between use and reducing shared objects. And typically in kindergarten, the first 2-hour time block in the morning, students would engage in a variety of activities and lessons planned by our kindergarten teacher. As in previous years, these activities would include whole group math and reading, and then small group stations as well. Depending on the day, the students would transition into music or PE. And then around 10:30, our students will go outside for recess, come back inside, wash their hands, and then go to lunch. They would be back in their classrooms engaging in lessons and a variety of activities that were planned by the instructor for the afternoon.
Thanks, Chad. And real
preschool, we have.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Maggie.
Oh, no, keep going here. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say, and in preschool, those are shorter sessions, and our students are going to have a separate exit or a separate entrance and exit into the building. They'll use the side door there on the preschool. These classrooms are some of our largest classrooms in the district and can accommodate appropriate social distancing for students.
Okay, and realistically, do you think that those preschool students, those younger children, maybe 4-, 5-, 6-year-olds, will be able to remain socially distanced?
Yeah, one of the things we're going to do in classrooms is we're really emphasizing rethinking space this year, and we know that that's going to be essential for the success of the school year. We're creating routines and engaging activities that promote social distancing. We're going to use a number of physical markers and visual cues on the floors to remind students of appropriate spacing, appropriate distance within the classroom.
Great. Thanks, Chad. So this question is probably more for Jim. And I know it was briefly addressed at the meeting this week, but maybe for those who weren't able to tune in, or perhaps you could maybe provide a bit more detail. But this listener asks, although the NCAA has canceled all D2 and D3 fall championships, we are going forward with adapted schedules for high school fall sports. So what structures are in place to ensure that our student athletes and coaches are safe throughout the season?
Yeah, definitely, Maggie. Again, that's a great question. This is Jim Wilson, again, the principal. That question has a lot of layers. If folks don't know, the NCAA is the governing body for college athletics, and the question's correct in stating they canceled sports championships. But I think looking into that a little bit further, Dr. Emmert, who's the president of the NCAA, did so because of the widespread community transmission in many of those college campus towns. And then also that combined with the interstate travel, that they were afraid would really increase the spread of that. So I think it's important to know that we're not the NCAA, so we don't have some of those same challenges. But we do still have COVID, of course. So our governing bodies are the NFHS, which is the National Federation of High School Activities, as well as ASA, which is the Alaska School of Activities Association. And they actually have recommended continuing with activities, but doing so in a very different manner. And we recognize that the seasons aren't going to look the same as they have in the past. Currently, what we're looking at is both the first two offerings, cross country and swimming, but are designated as low risk activities because they do not have contact between the participants. And so ASA has recommended that these activities can move forward so long as appropriate social distancing measures are in place. Coaches and non-participants are wearing masks. Competition is severely limited. In fact, for Unalaska, We have canceled or suspended all travel through October 15th, knowing that we would not want to be a part of sending our students into a high-risk area or potentially bringing them back from a high-risk area. So, you know, that's really, really important to us. But we also recognize at the same time that activities are an important part of the social and emotional well-being of our students, as is that physical exercise. And so OSAW, you know, has released protocols for us to be able to move forward and really have those on an intramural basis, which means practices here locally. If things were to change greatly statewide, we would look at travel again, but at this point in time, we're not going to do that. So, you know, we'll hold those two activities, social distancing. We'll also, you know, make sure that we're having those athletes divided into pods of no more than, you know, 7 to 10 athletes to be able to minimize their contact with one another. But we feel very comfortable moving forward. I actually met with a couple of coaches today and had a great meeting with them, both of our cross-country coaches as well as our swimming coaches yesterday. And we all feel comfortable moving forward with our minimized risk plan right now under the intermediate level the city has.
Great. Thanks for clarifying, Jim. This is a question that I think has been on many Unalaskans' minds. And this listener says, last year, many families were not able to access reliable internet, even with incredibly generous donations from Optumera. The Smart Start plan says distance education will take place online through Google Classroom and Seesaw. What has changed that will allow equal opportunity for students to access these sites? And how will you ensure equitable distance education for all of our students?
You know, this is John again, and thank you for that question, and thank you for the opportunity to give a shout out to Optumera again. We recognized them at our last school board meeting, and can't, you know, say enough how much we appreciate Optumera helping the entire community through a real crisis situation. Having students home for spring break and not being able to return to the building, having to ramp up the home-based education, Optumera really stepped up, helping teachers right off the bat with free internet, and then extending that to not only our UCSD students but our returning college students as well that had to finish their college courses online. And I think we've all lived in Unalaska long enough to know that we're praying for that fiber optic cable someday to be laid or some other ingenious technology. So we make do with what we have. A little bit of good news along those lines is we did qualify for some increased funding through the Broadband Assistance Grant, and that was a grant that we can use in conjunction with our E-rate funds, our federal E-rate funds, to increase the broadband pipe into the school. So we are looking at some solutions that would involve opening up the school to families who are choosing a home-based or virtual option to come in and use our internet. We believe we can do that in a safe way for families by appointment to come in and isolate themselves in a room and access our internet right here at the school. In addition, we continue to explore other options, you know, out in the community. And we're also looking at some, you know, medium tech solutions that we had some success with last spring as far as exchanging thumb drives or removable hard drives where teachers might put on a lecture or a video clip, and then we exchange those. And then we're looking at the no-tech as well as far as exploring some paper-pencil options, particularly for students in grades 6 through 12. And I think Mr. Wilson might have more to say. Do you have any more to say about that? Or I guess not. So I hope that answers the question. Again, Thank you, Optumera. We appreciate all the help last spring, and again, we're doing our best to provide that equity, and probably going to have to do that in a variety of ways to kind of shore up our our lack of, you know, internet coverage here in the community.
Thanks, John. This next question is a bit broader in scope. This listener says, Alaska's COVID protection measures recommended in city news releases advise Alaskans to, quote, avoid large gatherings, being in enclosed spaces with non-household members, and being around forceful exhalations like yelling and singing. Bringing kids back to school means that large groups of people will be in enclosed spaces with people outside of their household. How, in good conscience, can you recommend bringing kids back to school when it involves violation of those recommendations?
Yeah, that's a it's an interesting question. We've been in really close contact with the city and the Emergency Operations Center throughout the formulation of this plan. In fact, we had the city risk manager spend an afternoon with us, working through our plan and what she refers to the front of the house and the back of the house, and giving us a lot of great recommendations and guidance. We are, as we explained previously, really changing the way we do business here, rethinking our spaces. We won't be having any large gatherings. We're not going to be having any large school assemblies, unfortunately. We won't be having any band concerts where we're inviting members of the public, at least until this crisis is abated. I think it was explained during the questions about the music classes. We won't be having encouraging students to yell or sing loudly. And we do believe that, with a combination of these procedures, mitigations that we're putting in place, that that we can minimize the risk to return to school, and especially under the current conditions where there is no community spread of the coronavirus.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to comment on that as well, if that's okay.
Of course, go ahead.
So it's Megan Sarnicky, medical director at the clinic. I just also wanted to mention, I think this is a great question, and it brings up a lot of thoughts about the pandemic and how long it will go on and how we live our lives with minimal impact to our daily lives while still trying to protect ourselves. And I think when I think about it, too, I think, one of my big concerns when the pandemic started, I didn't have to worry about school at that point, was the processing plants. And they have to, unfortunately, have large gatherings with non-household members, being around each other, sometimes yelling to talk over their machinery. And so we thought very long and hard about the situations where we have to get into these situations to let our economy go on, to let people's livelihoods go on, and to allow kids to have development and progress this year. I think taking some risks is worthwhile. But I think it brings it back to this very key point, which is that the reason that the processing plants have done well is because we've kept it out of the processing plants. And we believe at this time that we don't have any community spread. And I really appreciate all the school's thought and decision-making and how to make the school safe. But it also is imperative that the community keeps being diligent with all the measures that are in place for the community to prevent community spread. These 14-day quarantines, when people come back from off the island, respecting those as diligently as you can. If someone in your household comes back, staying distanced from them, or if you can't stay distant, quarantining with them, wearing masks, trying not to be around people outside your household if you're not out of doors or if you're not masked. So all those things really help prevent the community spread. And not having community spread allows us to do things like continue our fishing industry and hopefully have school safely.
Thank you, Megan. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. I'm Maggie Nelson, and I'm here with school administrators John Conwell, Jim Wilson, and Chad Eichenlaub. We've also got Dr. Megan Sarnicki, medical director with IFHS, on the line, and KUCB's Hope McKinney is here in the studio with me as well. We're discussing the district's plan to open later this month and the measures that will be in place to protect local students, staff, and teachers. This next question addresses a concern that has come up at the previous board meetings and seems to be a popular topic of discussion regarding the reopening. This listener says, students come to school sick because they don't want to lose their perfect attendance record, but there are also parents who medicate their kids to subdue their fever and then send their children to school. How is UCSD going to address this?
Yeah, this is John Connell again, and I'll ask Dr. Sarnicki to weigh in on this as well. But as far as the school is concerned, we are greatly relaxing our attendance policies. We realize that it's just imperative that parents and keep their kids home if they're not feeling well, if they're sick, and our staff members as well. And so our attendance policies are going to look much different this year. And students will not be penalized for missing school because they're staying home during this pandemic. And Dr. Sarnicki, you might want to add to the other part.
Yeah, I also think this is a great question, and I know that this happens, and that we have lots of families in this community where both parents work, and childcare is challenging, and there is a temptation to send kids to school sick. And I think there's a very different risk to benefit ratio that we all have to weigh individually this year when making those decisions about when to send our kids to school. And I think, I also believe that this decision to not temperature screen the kids at school, I think that's the right thing to do, just because I think it brings staff and kids into close proximity, probably for very little benefit, because many kids with COVID won't have a fever. Although I understand the fear of kids showing up at school with a fever and wanting to catch those kids. But I think we have to rely on each other as parents and as a society to be honest with each other. And that's true not just in the school, but everywhere we go, that all of our actions affect each other. They always have, but the stakes are a little bit higher in the pandemic. I'm not sure if the school has if they're going to have assigned attestation from parents, quarterly or semesterly, saying that they won't send their kids to school, but it might be something to think about just to make sure that everybody's kind of read it and is on the same page. I know that's one of the things that the hospitals do, for example. They don't, the hospital at Prov is not actually temperature screening their employees, but they are asking them to attest every day that they are not ill before they come into work.
And is that something?
Yeah, this, Mr. Conwell, we
go ahead, John.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. We are actually doing a form asking parents to attest that their children, if they've returned to Unalaska from a trip off island, that they have completed their 14-day quarantine. But we'll certainly look into that recommendation as well.
Thank you, and maybe Megan, you can speak to this one as well. One of our listeners asks, the clinic uses an Abbott test that is documented to be missing as many as 48% of COVID-19 infections. Are you concerned about relying on this test as we get ready to start the school year?
Yeah, we do have an Abbott, and it was the first test that we acquired, but we also have a Cepheid. And the majority of our tests are conducted on the Cepheid. I would argue that the Abbott is actually far more sensitive than 48%, but that being said, the initial estimates were somewhere around 70%. Both on the Abbott and the Cepheid, we send all of our testing to the state, all of our negatives and positives, quite frankly, to the state to verify. They have not found any positives that we haven't found on their much more sensitive machine. But the Cepheid is more sensitive. It can detect lower copies per mil than the Abbott. We do the majority of our testing on the Cepheid, mostly because we've been lucky enough to get Cepheid test kits. A lot of our testing decisions are made based on what test kits we have available to us at any given time. And we've been very lucky so far, and our supply chain looks good for the immediate future, but it's always a concern going forward. I think it's a great question, like, what is the false negative rate of a test? And to always think about when you get a test, if it's a very high-risk person, we would certainly be concerned. Again, the plan is to shut school down at the first community case. So somebody shouldn't have, for example, a COVID contact coming in, therefore giving them a much higher pretest probability for their test. Because the minute we get one community case, whether that's a student, a teacher, or someone who works at Safeway, the school will be shut down. That is the current plan, which is quite conservative, and I feel also necessary based on the risks involved of running school in a community that does have community spread. So Cepheid has, we don't know, but we think it's well over 90%, the sensitivity. And again, we haven't had tests from the state come back positive that were negative here. The other piece to think about is when we do the swab, we try to be very thorough. And we've been told in our testing here that we are very thorough. If everyone's had their swab for COVID here compared to other places off island, I think that we are being very thorough with those swabs. So that's the other piece is picking it up on the actual person that contributes to the sensitivity of those tests.
Okay, thank you for clarifying, Megan. So we've got another question from a listener, a little bit off topic, but they want to know, why wouldn't we partner with Optumera this year? They say Optumera could put a hotspot in every house and actually give every student access to internet. While Telalaska cannot.
I guess I'll try to respond to that. We have some very restrictive E-rate rules that are attached to our E-rate funding that covers about 60% of our internet connection that we share with between both schools and the public library. So. The school district has to be very careful. Our current provider is Telalaska, so when we have to be very careful about extending out our network in that sort of way. I know that there have been, I've been following very closely what the Lucians East Borough School District has been doing. They've been working on E-rate waivers, and in fact, it had been rejected because they were looking at doing something similar to what's described. So I'm hoping that the E-rate rules will be relaxed if this pandemic continues. I've taken that concern directly to Senator Lisa Murkowski just in the last couple of weeks. So it's definitely something that would help us here if those funding rules would be relaxed, and then we could bring in other internet providers. But right now, the district has to follow those federal laws and abide by those.
Okay, thank you. And we're running a little short on time now. So I want to step into our questions regarding if and when students, teachers, or staff do test positive for the virus, and kind of move back to what Megan was speaking to a little bit ago. But to start with, what are the district protocol and specific district and classroom steps that will be taken when a student tests positive for COVID-19? Will the class or school be quarantined?
Well, this is John Conwell. As Dr. Sarnecki mentioned, if we have a positive case, the school will close. And I don't know, Dr. Sarnecki has anything to add to that?
Yeah, so there will contact tracing, just like in all our cases, will go on. I actually am hopeful that it will get better. We are in the process of working with the state to get local contact tracers. So we think we'll have 5 local people trained up, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, to do our own contact tracing, so that there won't be any delays as the state counts climb. So definitely anybody who had been a contact of the student or staff would be informed that they had been exposed. They would be asked to quarantine for 14 days, watch for symptoms, and we would ask them to come in for testing if they had symptoms. If they had an asymptomatic infection, they should no longer be symptomatic at the end of the 14-day period, and that's kind of the standard for COVID-exposed treatment and contact tracing.
Okay, and how are you balancing this contact tracing in this public health crisis with the HIPAA privacy rules?
Yeah, it's a great question, and that's part of a big part of what we're hoping to learn with the contact tracing specifically. And once we have contact tracers that are employed by the state, so you're right, we have very tight HIPAA rules. The clinic does. There's been some in conjunction with the state where we are allowed to release small amounts of information, for example, about our positives that we put in our updates through the City of Onalaska and the EOC. And we will continue to release pertinent information to the community, but then also, so when you call someone, and again, I haven't been trained in the contact tracing, but in a general sense, say there was someone in the third grade, one of the third grade classrooms who had been positive for COVID, you call everyone in the third grade, say there was someone in your class, in your school, you know, your child was exposed at school, but they wouldn't be given a name of who that person was. And the important part is that you've been exposed and you need to quarantine, and you need to be watching for symptoms. So, and you might get a call saying you've been exposed on a plane, you've been exposed. They'll tell you, I don't even know, maybe they don't tell you where you were exposed, but they definitely don't tell you who the person was.
Okay, thank you. And this question was kind of mentioned in the board meeting, especially in regard to the adoption of the new emergency employee leave. But just to recap and maybe shed some more light on the topic, what is your plan for an increased need for substitutes? Are those substitutes aware and willing to work in classrooms where a teacher or student may show symptoms or something of the virus? And what will happen if a teacher needs to take an extended leave due to COVID complications?
Yeah, that's a good question. We, even in a typical year, we struggle, especially at the beginning of the year, to fill our substitute lists. We have this year been very proactive in reaching out to our regular substitute teachers and have asked them to come in for our, you know, to be trained during our teacher in service. That's not typically something we do. You know, I'm sure we'll be getting a feel then for how our substitute teachers are looking at the new year and you know, working in the classrooms. I guess the second part of the question, as far as teachers who may be on extended leave, you know, we have policies in place that we would, I guess, treat that as any other leave. There's, you know, there's sort of different classifications. Of course, if a teacher in any circumstance needs to leave their classroom because of an illness, then we would arrange for a substitute teacher. By state law, if a teacher is out for more than 20 consecutive days, the district has to attempt to find a certificated teacher to put in that classroom. And so, again, we would follow all of our local policies and procedures and state law with regard to covering teachers who may need to be out due to a COVID-19-related illness.
Thank you, John. So now we've got a slightly more grim question, but certainly a valid one. This listener says, over the summer, Three teachers in Arizona all tested positive for COVID-19 after teaching virtual summer school lessons together from the same classroom, and one of them died. How are you preparing for the possibility of that happening locally with students and or teachers?
Yeah, this is John Connell again. I don't know all of the specifics behind that that incident in Arizona. I think I remember seeing something about it on the news. It's difficult to prepare for any sort of tragedy. As we all know, we've been through a rough couple of years here in Unalaska. I think that, just on its face, if it was three teachers teaching out of the same classroom, I think maybe the lesson learned from that is that you don't put three teachers in close proximity in a classroom. So I think, like we explained, we have our teachers here teaching in separate classrooms, practicing social distancing. As I mentioned before, we're going to really emphasize with our teachers and staff that as tempting as it is to get together in the teacher's lounge or visiting in the hallways, that we're going to have to curtail those habits some and really be role models for our students in practicing wearing our face coverings and practicing social distancing and washing our hands frequently and again doing that combination of things that will help slow the spread of the virus. And maybe Dr. Czarnecki would like to respond to that question as well.
Yeah, it is a great question, and it's, I think this is the crux of everything in the pandemic. It's sort of everything we do is this going to lead to critical illness or death in someone in my community, in my family? And we all have to make these decisions all the time and weigh the pros and cons of everything that we do. And like I said, I truly believe that the balance between the risk of contagion and the risk of the developmental effects from not holding school, while we have no community spread, I truly believe this is the right thing to do, that the risk of not holding school while we have no community spread would be a greater damage. But we don't know exactly how this is going to turn out. But with all the science and data that we have been gathering over the last 5 months, the school district's plan is, I think it's very strong. And again, I think we're lucky enough to be in a community that hasn't had community spread. And we all bear the responsibility for how COVID-19 enters our community and how it spreads. So this just gets back to all of us completing 14-day quarantines when entering our community, wearing masks in public, trying to keep 6 feet away from non-family members, monitoring ourselves for symptoms and coming in and getting testing, and avoiding gatherings with non-household members outside of our critical functions like school and work.
Thank you, Dr. Czarnecki. That listener also asks, should the community hold the school accountable if COVID-19 spreads in Unalaska following the start of the school year?
This is John Conwell. That's a hard question. I recently was in a meeting with some other superintendents around the state, and I know that one superintendent was concerned because their community had decided to reopen schools without any sort of precautions put in place, and so I think that we've been asked, I guess, as a society and different segments of our society to take these precautions to minimize the risk as much as possible, not eliminate the risk, but to reduce it as much as possible. So I guess if we were negligent in not taking any precautions in opening our schools, then yes, probably we could be held accountable. But I believe that we are we're taking reasonable precautions, and again asking for the community support and family support to follow all these protocols so that we can open schools safely. And I'll punt to Dr. Czarnecki. She probably has a far more eloquent response to that question.
No, I think your response was great, John, and I'm not sure that I have a lot to add from what I said to the last one, but I agree. I feel very grateful and privileged to live in a community with such thoughtful school administration and experienced school administrators who do not take this lightly. We've been working closely with them since the pandemic started, and we will continue as the healthcare community to work closely with the school to do this as safely as we can. And I absolutely agree that I think you're doing it in the safest way possible. And I think it wouldn't be in the community's best interest to not hold school. Again, we constantly have to weigh not holding school versus the contagion. And I do think this is the correct answer.
Great. Thank you, Megan and John, for addressing some of those tougher questions. And I know you touched on this already, John, but we are coming to the end of our program. So maybe you can recap quickly in our last couple minutes. If we do end up seeing positive cases of COVID-19 among students or staff and the district has to transition back to home-based education, what will that look like? Are the district and staff and students prepared for that?
Yes, we would have to pivot back to home-based. That's another reason why we're very hopeful that we can reopen school here in less than 2 weeks so that we can, I guess, onboard our students and staff in the event that we do have to go to home-based. We are going to be very proactive in assigning students computer devices so that they know that is their computer device to borrow from the school to take with them from class to class. And if we do suddenly have to pivot to home-based, they can take that device home with them. They'll know, they'll be trained in knowing what to take with them as far as textbooks and materials. We're going to spend, a lot of time with that during this first 3 days and the first couple weeks of school, getting folks ready for the likelihood, really, that we will need to, from time to time, be learning from home.
Great, thank you. And I think we are about out of time for today. I apologize if I wasn't able to get to your question. I'm Maggie Nelson, and you've been listening to our live show with Unalaska School Administrators John Conwell, Jim Wilson, and Chad Eichenlaub, as well as IFHS Medical Doctor Megan Sarnecki. We've been discussing the district's plan to open later this month and the measures that will be in place to protect local students, staff, and teachers. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thanks so much for doing the show.
Thank you, KUCB.